The central government of the People's Republic of China had its needs, and those needs were to industrialize the country. So they had to go out and borrow money to buy equipment and whatnot. And what did that mean to the peoples out in those communes, Frank Decoder?
The command from above always comes in the form of a quota. There is a demand for grain output, for steel production, and of course they frequently clash. But the local carver has to fulfill and overfulfill the demands for the plan. So he will quite literally whip up the workforce and drive people to fulfill this or that quota, often to their death. And when the grain output can't be reached, the figures are just made up. But of course, once the figures are made up for grain output, the state comes and takes what it sees as its share, its procurement, and very, very little is left behind for the farmers to eat. So a lot of this really results in extraordinary little food left in the villages once the state has come to procure most of it. There are places where literally 80-90% of the harvest is confiscated, and villages are left with a very small amount, which is distributed by the spoonful and only to those who actually contribute to the regime through their labor.
So if you can work, you can get paid but in food, and if you can't work, you do not get paid in food. And what happens to the people then that do not get paid in food?
They starve. Some of them are starved deliberately because they don't contribute to the regime, because they're too old or too weak or too sick, because they've spoken out. Others try to flee, to try to get by and forage in the mountains or somehow escape to the city. Frequently, they are arrested and sent back to the village, only to meet punishment at the hands of the local carders. It's a very tough system. By 1960-61, there are villages where you had thousands of people and nothing but a dozen remain. People
Wow.
literally start scavenging everything around them. The bark from trees, they eat the thatch from their own roofs. They will sell everything they have, even the clothes on their own bodies. They will break down their own houses, try to sell the bricks.
And you talk about Guanyin and Yang Li Shi.
Guanyin is a goddess, but Guanyin is also the name of a very white, translucent type of mud, which looks very much like porcelain. And when people are very close to starvation, they start digging up that type of earth. And they either eat it straight, or they will use it to make cakes, mix it up with some bark or with some grass, and pretend that these are cakes. The tragedy, of course, is that once the mud has been ingested, it dries up, and the person who has eaten it will suffer from horrendous constipation. Frequently, the person is so blocked up that it leads to death. It's an absolutely awful way to die.
So when everything else has been eaten, there are only two things left to eat, and one of them is the good earth itself, the guanyin, and the other is?
Well, of course, like in all famines, and this is true for Europe, and it's true, of course, also for the Soviet Union, people start digging up bodies of other people.
You know, here in the United States, we have our own cannibalism story. It's the story of the Donner Party, who got trapped in the Sierras and were forced to eat the remains of human bodies. But in China, it went so much beyond that, because there was an actual black market. It was in human body parts for food.
There are reports where in the cities people go to a black market because there is no such thing as a market. It's all in the hands of the state. But people go to a black market and buy some meat only to find a human ear in it. There are stories like that. There are reports by the police compiled at the time that testify to the existence of such stories.
And in those, interesting to note, in those reports that you report on, they list livelihood issues as a cause.
That's the term. Livelihood issues is always the reason given by the Public Security Bureau for cases of cannibalism. This is the reason that is given, livelihood issues. Of course, it's just a politically correct way of saying that these people were really starving to death. But what I always make clear when I talk about this is that when people started digging up bodies and eating them, what they were doing, they were really reduced to doing so. But far greater horrors were inflicted by the state on living human beings. So to me, cannibalism is not the worst, if you wish, defilement of the human body during that time. It is what the regime did to living human beings, how it worked or exhausted people to death, which is the really obscene aspect of this whole famine.
Describe the efforts to produce steel and what that meant to those communes of farmers.
The vision by Mao was that the real wealth of China resided in it, many millions of people, hundreds of millions of farmers. If only all of them could be turned into foot soldiers, and if all of them could turn to producing steel in backyard furnaces, then steel production would just surge ahead, and China would be able to overtake England in the production of steel. England at the time was still considered to be a major industrial power. But of course, in many of these villages, these backyard furnaces were very poorly built, and the steel that came out was useless. And the tragedy is not so much what came out of it, but what went into it. What went into these backyard furnaces were pots, pans, tools, doorknobs, just about anything that people could find made of steel went into it.
And what did they fire the...
In the need to fulfill these quotas for steel production imposed by leaders at the county level.
And what did they use to fire those...
Waste of resources.
What did they use to fire those furnaces, Frank?
Say it again?
What did they use to fire those furnaces?
They used wood. And here's another tragedy. Of course, we talk about how human beings were destroyed during this period, but there was also an extraordinary assault on nature, as farmers were obliged to fan through the forest and chop down trees like never before to fan the fires of these backyard furnaces that produced very little of any value. So not only were farmers confronted with an absolute lack of pots, pans, tools to work the land, but they were surrounded by cut down forests, hills, devoid of any forest at all.
Hold on, Frank. We have to take a quick break. We'll be right back. We'll be right back. This is The Food Chain.
Loans made pursuant to the California Department of Corporations Finance Lenders Law License Number 603J903, NMLS 954578, see website or call for terms and restrictions.
Mortgage rates are going back up. The door's closing on your chance at the best refinance opportunity in generations. You've tried, but banks are tighter than ever. Afraid you'll miss out? It's not too late. Open Gate Lending can succeed where others fail with their unique Do It Right Refi program.
We've been trying to refinance our home for years, and we finally did with Open Gate Lending, and the process didn't take long.
We've been turned away from other home loan agents. Our new loan is saving us $498 per month.
With Open Gate's Do It Right Refi, you can get past tight-fisted bankers and save an average of $600 a month. Open Gate is a direct lender, so they can say yes even when others keep saying no. Call 800-430-4000. Learn how you can get up to $800 cash to make up for wasted interest payments on your old loan. Call 800-430-4234. 800-430-4234.
Open Gate Lending. Health insurance is on everyone's mind right now. You either don't have it, or you have it and you think it's too expensive, and you probably feel like you don't have any options. We can help. We are InSphere Insurance Solutions. We offer health insurance plans from major carriers nationwide and likely to have a plan that can save you money. Whether you're self-employed, on a COBRA plan that's about to expire, or you simply don't have health insurance where you work and you need it, InSphere Insurance Solutions can help you. Our agents will help you find coverage you can afford. InSphere Insurance Solutions is an authorized agency in all 50 states, including the District of Columbia. Plans may not be available in all states.
800-637-1632. 800-637-1632. 800-637-1632. That's 800-637-1632.
If you're struggling to pay or haven't been making your student loan payments, listen carefully to this urgent alert. Have you been out of school for 10 or more years and you're still making your student loan payments? Are your student loans past due or even in default? Can't go back to school because of an old student loan problem? Fast Track Student Loans can get your student loans out of default, stop any wage garnishments, stop collection calls, and stop seizure of your tax refund. Give yourself a break. Stop the stress and get your student loan payments down to as little as $25 a month based on what you can afford to pay. One quick 10-minute call could help you solve your student loan problems. So call right now. Not available in all states. Payments may vary based on income. 800-731-7534. 800-731-7534. 800-731-7534. 800-731-7534.
Mouse said it best himself when he said that revolution is no dinner party. And so to change the way farmers of 40 centuries were doing things, he had to really turn the country literally upside down and inside out, to the extent that almost nothing was left. What was left after they built their dams and they made their steel? What did the countryside look like, Frank Decoder?
It was quiet, eerily quiet, because there were no animals left, because the people were pretty much, those still alive, were starved into silence. Very few trees had been chopped down. A landscape that was also, strangely enough, devoid of many houses. In a province of, like, Hunan, which is about the size of France, 30-40% of the houses were destroyed simply because people tried to sold the bricks, or the bricks were needed to build canteens, or they were used as fertilizer on the soil. That was really a landscape that would probably remind you of Europe in 1945, bombed out.
And a consequence of the Great Leap Forward. Now, sooner or later, there had to, you know, come to grips with the fact that you can make steel and you can build aqueducts and dams, and then you also have the need to grow food. And sooner or later, when you deconstruct all of those farms of 40 centuries and turn them into massive communes with the responsibility of making steel and building dams, something has to give, and it was the food, right?
Yes. Well, yes and no, in the sense that food was still being produced, but most of it was taken away to feed factories in the cities, to feed the cities themselves, to feed the army, and of course also to export to the Soviet Union to pay for all the equipment that China was buying at the time in order to fuel its great leap forward and catapult China past all its competitors. So the real tragedy is, of course, that for a country that proclaimed its belief in total equality, there was a very, very strict hierarchy, and the losers were the cultivators, the very producers of the food themselves in the countryside.
And once again, how can you take food from the people who grew the food and still get them to grow the food?
There's only one way that it could be done at the time, and that was by the use of systematic violence and terror, by placing all the available food in the hands of the carters, who had to whip up the workforce. Not a very pleasant regime. And, of course, not a regime that was able to last. The whole thing collapsed by 1962, and China was forced to somehow revert back to a less radical vision of collectivization.
How did that process work? You know, once you get everything completely turned upside down and inside out, and it fails, then what did they do? I mean,
the sheer scale of devastation in terms of human beings, damage to the environment, collapse of the transportation system, the erosion of the whole fabric of society, the scale of the devastation was such that by 1961, the Communist Party was obliged to revert back to earlier years and allow farmers to go back and have a private plot. And it's those private plots that really managed China to get out of that horrendous famine.
So he had essentially to give up, Mao did. What did Mao do then?
In part. Only small private plots were allowed. The collectives remained in place. The people's communes were not abolished until the 1980s. But in practice, most of the food came from those very tiny private plots that farmers were somehow allowed to cultivate.
And when China really started coming to grips with the fact that the Great Leap Forward really was a kind of like a Great Leap Backwards, how did Mao hold on to power?
Well, it's a long, complicated story, but... It can be summarized in two words, cultural revolution. He launched the cultural revolution in 1966, 4 years after the end of the famine, and it was an attempt to get rid of every leader in the party who was critical of what Mao had done to his country during the Great Leap Forward.
So those people who stood up and said the Great Leap Forward did not work found themselves...
Not just... Very few stood up and said the Great Leap doesn't work. One or two did. The vast majority somehow had grudges. And Mao eliminated anybody and everybody who he even remotely suspected of having expressed any form of even mild discontent with the Great Leap Forward. By 1966, this is a very old and paranoid man willing to get rid even of long-standing colleagues who had worked with him side by side for 30, 40 years.
It was a culture of people and not of laws.
It was a culture of power, a culture of absolute power, where one man's dictate was very much what set the country on its course to self-destruction.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, folks, but when we come back, I want to ask Frank Decoter, author of Mao's Great Famine, the big question. Did Mao's government starve 45 million people to death by accident of policy or by willful intent, an act of willful intent? I mean, after all, they had to do something to turn over 40 centuries of tradition. Do stay tuned, right back.
You want healthy food? We are helping you get it. Hello, I'm Maureen Wilmot, Executive Director of the Organic Farming Research Foundation. Our mission at OFRF is to foster the widespread adoption and improvement of the organic farming systems so we can all eat clean, healthy food. Meet some of the people who are putting organic food on your table.
I'm Jeremy Barker Plotkin. I run Simple Gifts Farm in Amherst, Massachusetts. We produce vegetables and pigs and chickens and cows. OFRF is one of the few national organizations that's working for organic farmers.
OFRF funds organic research for farmers, builds communities of support for organic farming, and advocates for organic farming policies in Washington, D.C. Help organic farmers. Buy organic food. Join the OFRF community. Contribute to organic farming research. Visit OFRF.org. Remember, when an organic farmer succeeds, we all thrive.
Wow, MetroFarm.com says we can earn a 5-, 6-, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city.
And we don't even have to own the land. We can lease it year to year.
MetroFarm.com says we can grow fruit on prairie bench lands, houseplants in coastal valleys, vegetables in city greenbelts, and ornamentals in neighborhoods of fancy homes.
We can even grow flowers on our wooded hillside.
Get all the information you need to grow for profit at MetroFarm.com, including the complete guide to earning 5-, 6-, and 7-figure incomes by farming small parcels of land. Meet the farmers who earn the money. Find experts at MetroFarm.com who will examine your property and assess which crops to grow. Meet consultants who will help steer your project to profitability. And get the latest news about the business of growing high-value specialty crops for the city at MetroFarm.com.
We've always dreamed about farming a small parcel of land. At MetroFarm.com, we can get all the help we need to stop dreaming and start growing.